to me, it's the hunter's responsibility to protect the dog because the dog's not going to protect himself. You got to be careful too. You can hurt a dog. It's a thing to be aware of. It's a dangerous life being a bird dog. The fact that more of them don't get hurt is surprising, really, because it is a extremely dangerous life.
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast. Steve Snell with me today. Thanks for joining me today, buddy.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I checked the archives. Episode number 12 was your first appearance on the Birdshot Podcast. That was back in 2018. Yeah, okay. So it's been a while.
It has.
Yep. I know we bumped into each other a few times at Pheasant Fest, and I think that was a couple of years ago now. We were chatting about shotguns, and
yeah,
at that time was like, hey, we should get you back on the show at some point. And you and I were just talking about kids, and time flies, that's for sure.
It does.
What's going on in your world? How are things at Gun Dog Supply? And
it's good.
Yeah?
It's good. Yeah, spring is typically our slower time of the year. Once we kind of get past the beginning of the training part of it, it tends to slow down just a little bit. So we have a chance to catch up and get a few things done. So
yeah.
That's nice. It's a nice break.
I would imagine, but I guess I don't know. Like, do you see real big spikes in like sales like this time of year, and then like people are getting dogs and training stuff, and then obviously fall hunting season, or is it not that seasonal?
Yeah, it really picks up for us middle of August. You kind of have that, everybody starts going, oh, dove season.
Yeah, preseason, excitement.
Upland season's kind of open, and people, even if you're not hunting that part of the year, you know, other people are. So you're seeing stuff, and you start thinking about it. And so it really kicks in about middle of August, and then it rolls pretty hard until January, you know, and then we kind of hit training season, you know, and so that's, you know, February, March, April, kind of depending on where you are. Yeah. So then typically the summers are slower time of the year. You know, as it gets hot and there's, you know, only so much you can do.
Yeah, that's we see the similar cycle in the shotgun business too. So it's that time of year, and there's, as much as we love to chase our dogs around and carry our double guns, there are other things to do in the summertime too.
Yeah.
Well, for anybody that hasn't been listening since 2018 and maybe missed that first episode or is not familiar with us, Give us a little intro on Steve and Gun Dog Supply. Now, apologies if this was AI surfacing the wrong information, but is that really a family-owned business since 1972?
Yeah, my parents started the company in 72.
Man, I did not recall that.
Yeah, I was 2 years old.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up in it.
It was destiny.
Yeah, it's been a little different. It started out as a manufacturing and then it became more of a, you know, we were always mail order company, but it's really funny because, you know, we talk about mail order nowadays, but that was back in the days when you actually, you know, I remember clearly going to the post office with my mother and picking up, you know, actual paper orders with checks, and that's how it was done, you know, back in the 70s and, you know, and 80s. And so, you know, we would take phone orders, but credit cards, you know, I'm sure some folks have find it hard to believe, but, you know, credit cards weren't that normal in the 70s getting. So it was, yeah, a little different business. We really became more of a retail business and a dog food business in the 80s up to about the mid 90s. We got back into the mail order pretty hard. You know, we never got out of it, but we got back into it pretty hard in the 93, 94, somewhere in that neighborhood. I actually wasn't with, you know, I was, my brother and I were doing some other stuff at that time. And in 95, we started putting stuff on the internet. And so, you know, real early.
That was pretty early. Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty early. We actually started out just putting a catalog request form online, and we were getting so many catalog requests. My dad was like, yeah, I'm not sending the catalogs out like that. Yeah. And I question that these are even real customers.
Right. Right.
Like, you put us online or you cut this thing off. And so we went online, and like I said, we were live in 96, 97.
Wow.
And we're in that neighborhood. It got out of hand pretty quick as far as what my parents were comfortable with. And, my brother did the internet stuff, set him up online. Okay. I had to come in 98 just to help because it had gotten out of hand. And then we started, Rob and I started running it pretty heavily, you know, in 98, 99, and, been doing it ever since.
Man, that's wild.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. You know, I'm primarily a quail hunter.
Yeah.
So the vast majority of it I enjoy. It's my, you know, it's pretty much all I do.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you guys grow up with dogs and all that sort of thing? Yeah.
I mean, I remember waiting on my dad to come home, you know, clean birds when I was, you know, 5, 6, you know, in that range. You know, his entire, you know, his brother was big bird hunter. He was a big bird hunter. Had an uncle that was a farmer, actually uncle of his, so a great uncle of mine. You know, he quail hunted 6 days a week.
Well,
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of grew up in that.
That sounds good. That sounds good. But what does a typical hunting season look like for you? Do you end up taking a lot of traveling trips, or?
I don't really have a set. This is exactly how I do it. We usually start late September. Typically the weather is a bit rough, you know, for me. A lot of folks like to start, you know, September 1st, in Montana. I have done that. It's usually miserable. I like to, if I'm going to Montana or the Dakotas, I like to get up in there, you know, late September, early October. I try to avoid most of the pheasant openers those tend to be crowded. So I kind of work around pheasant season. I prefer prairie birds over pheasants. So I tend to, you know, kind of dodge, opening weekends. But I don't have a consistent, you know, it just kind of depends on what's going on. I've hunted Canada, I've hunted Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska. And then Texas opens in November. It's typically too hot, but I'll sometimes go. I'm fortunate that I have access to wild birds in Mississippi. And so, we open, Thanksgiving. So I hunt here, and, you know, once November kicks in, sometimes I'll go to Kansas, Nebraska that time of year, just because of weather. And then once, after Thanksgiving, I'm typically either in Mississippi or Texas, and then it rolls until the end of February for Texas. And Mississippi actually goes to the first Saturday in March is the end of our season. Yeah. It's a bit much, but, there are not a lot of wild birds or wild bird hunting left in Mississippi. So it's not, you know, but it is weird to, like I said, we could actually hunt, you know, into the first week of March.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're just finishing up basics.
Yeah. It can be a long time. A lot of times.
Right.
I don't turkey hunt, and I don't.
Okay.
But usually by the time March rolls around, you know, if I have a young dog, I'm training puppies. But usually I'm glad to be home by the time March hits, if it's a year.
Yeah, that is, it's nice to have that flexibility and those options, and maybe to get out and scratch the itch, you know, towards the end there, so you can shorten the wait until next season, but
yeah, I know a lot of folks, you know, they're through, you know, the end of the year. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of weird for me, you know, because we don't really get rolling good, you know. January and February are probably my favorite months to hunt, really. So, you know, so it just, a lot of it depends on where you are and what you're used to.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, the weather plays a huge role, especially early season. I mean, we've been dealing with a lot of heat, it seems like, the last few years for sure.
Last year was the worst.
Yeah.
It was either brutally cold or so hot you couldn't run dogs.
And yeah, I do remember it oscillating back and forth quite a bit.
Yeah, it was terrible. Last year was, we had probably some of the best bird numbers that I've seen in a long time.
And, okay.
But the worst hunting conditions, you know, just as far as, you know, you're having to get up and be out there at sunrise and you're through at 9 o'clock, you know. So it was a weird year. It was a very weird
That's year. A long day ahead of you. I don't really like that. Like, I much prefer, one of my favorite times to hunt is as you get later in the season for rough grouse hunting up here, like the afternoon. I mean, the golden hour, right?
Oh,
like everybody kind of ease into your day and like set it up to where you can kind of start midday and finish it out. That whole like hurry up and get out there because it's going to get too hot. It's, I mean, it's part of the game, but I don't like that.
I'm not a fan. Yeah. It's a good, you got to be careful too. You can hurt a dog. We hunt in more heat than I care for, but you know, it is one of those things. Like Texas, I typically use about 65 degrees as my cutoff. Yeah, Texas is just weird as far as you know, we can hunt, you know, it can be 40 degrees out there and you can hunt in a t-shirt, you know, just because of, you know, humidity and sun, and so, or lack of humidity, and so it's a little different. You gotta be careful
in those big wide open spaces too. Like, it's amazing how, you know, cloud cover and wind play a role. Like a 70 degree day with a lot of clouds and a little breeze, much different than, you know, dead calm bluebird 72, that kind of thing.
But, we're through if it's, yeah, if it's sunny and there's no wind and it's,
yeah,
you know, like I said, it I'll never run a dog over 70 when it's like that. It's just, you know, rattlesnakes start coming out.
That's the other thing. The last interview I did, I was talking to he lives in Wyoming, my buddy Keith, and we got to talk about snakes, I think. And he said, he would almost take, we were kind of questioning, would you prefer rattlesnakes or being in tick country? So I'll ask you that, Steve. Do you have an aversion to ticks at all, or do you not worry about it?
I'm not a fan, but typically with a tick, you don't have to go to the emergency room. So yeah.
Right.
I mean, they're a problem and you want to watch out for them, and they can be extremely dangerous. Yeah. Rattlesnakes will kill you.
Yeah.
So, I'll take ticks any day of the week.
Yeah. That was kind of my thinking. But again, I was pulling ticks off my dogs basically every day. It's not a ton. I was out turkey hunting this week, and right now the wood ticks are really bad, but the dogs pick up obviously lots of deer ticks, as we call them. And I mean, it's unavoidable. Like, you got to treat your dogs, take them off when you see them, and it is what it is. But
yeah, you want to avoid them. But, you know, and snakes are, so I've been hunting in Texas since I was probably 22, so 30 plus years.
Yep.
I've probably had four, maybe five snake encounters.
Okay.
You know, in that time period.
That's a fairly low frequency.
Yeah. I don't hunt South Texas on a regular basis. You know, South Texas, you're dealing with snakes pretty much year round. I'm hunting in what's referred to as the rolling plains. I go up into the panhandle a little bit. And we have snakes, you know, I mean, most of my, and it would probably surprise folks, the temperatures that you will run into rattlesnakes. You know, we had a dog, buddy of mine had a dog get bit 2 years ago and it was probably 40 degrees. You know, so they will, they can be active, you know, at the time. So it is something to pay attention to.
Like, the rules are there's guidelines, but they're not hard and fast rules, right?
Yeah. But I mean, you can have such extreme weather out there where I've been out there where, you know, on Tuesday it was highs in the 80s and wake up to, you know, 10 degrees. So, you know, you can have such giant swings that snakes will come out.
Yeah.
And then you'll run into them. I've run into snakes when it was so cold that the snakes were having a hard time moving around.
Yeah.
You know, which is good. You know, that's
right. Right.
You just kind of when they're
steer
slow.
Clear. Yeah.
So it's a thing to be aware of. It's a dangerous life being a bird dog. I mean,
right.
You know, the fact that more of them don't get hurt is surprising, really, because it is a extremely dangerous life.
Yeah, that's what you pointed out there. It's like when something does happen, I'm always thinking to myself, like, how do they not?
Yeah.
How do my dogs not go in the grouse woods every day and poke themselves with a stick or do something? You know, the speed at which they move through the woods, it's amazing. But
and the majority of them have no, you know, they're not worried about themselves.
No, they're not.
Yeah. They show very little concern for self-preservation.
Yeah. So, okay. So just before we leave that thread, so you mentioned like geography a little bit, maybe trying to stay out of like super snaky areas, but when it comes to the decision of, okay, I'm going to hunt or not, or what other sort of snake avoidance things go through your mind when you're putting a dog in a specific place?
You know, you do have to deal with like I stay out of rocky areas unless it's super cold.
Okay.
You know, cause that's typically where they're going to den.
Yep. I've heard the rocky outcroppings thing. Yep.
You know, I have never done snake avoidance. I'm not opposed to it. I just haven't really had, there's not much of that in this part of the world. And, I haven't dealt with it. But I know a lot of folks, you know, I've seen dogs that have had snake avoidance and they deal with it, you know, pretty well. I am fortunate in that I have enough time generally that I can pick and choose. One of the things that I think people struggle with, especially traveling, is that they have a real narrow window that they're having to fit, a trip into.
Yeah.
And they want to hunt as much as they can, which I fully understand, but
you can't just say, I'll just hunt tomorrow. That kind of thing. Not everybody has that luxury.
Yeah. But you've got to be careful about that because that's where it can become very dangerous. We had my first trip, maybe it was first or second trip to Wyoming. We lined up everything and it looked perfect. Everything was going to be great. The weather was going to be perfect. And at the last minute it changed and we were finding more snakes than we were finding birds. You know, and so it was just one of those things of, okay, well, this is just going to, this is not going to work out. And so, that happens, you've got to have some, to me, it's the hunter's responsibility to protect the dog because the dog's not going to protect himself. A good dog, is not going to, they'll kill themselves given the opportunity. If it's hunting or protecting themselves, they're going to hunt. And, it's your job to pick and choose and go, well, things didn't work out. And that's tough. That's a hard decision, for me. But I think you need to kind of know that going in. Because like I said, it there reaches a point. Now you'll run into a lot of guys that, I know guys that have guided in South Texas and they're out there and they're switching out dogs every 7 minutes, because it's so hot.
Just to keep them fresh and keep hunting. Yeah.
Just to protect them. And, I typically don't hunt in that kind of stuff. But it is one of those things you just have to make some calls on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So of those like 4 and 5 encounters that you had, like, was there, what was the most serious? Were you running to the ER? Like what
no,
happened?
Actually, of those encounters, I've never had a dog get bit. I've been more fortunate from that standpoint. Like I said, I've had a buddy's dog get bit. That may be the only one that I even know of. Typically we run into snakes. We're going to move as far away as we can. We're going to get the dogs, away from them. So I've been very fortunate from that standpoint that I haven't had that happen. And so I think some of that is, I have pretty strict rules as far as, weather and how we hunt. So we just don't run into a lot of them. You'll see them on the road and that kind of stuff. You're driving around.
Yeah.
But we've been fortunate, from that standpoint.
Yeah. Okay.
Porcupines. I tend to attract porcupines. That's my,
okay.
Well, that's my skill. Yeah.
I was just going to ask. So like we have, you've got the rattlesnake and like up here in my part of the world, it's the wolf. Like the frequency of occurrence is really, really low, but it's this big, the boogeyman. It's like the scary monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like, I was going to ask you, what is the thing that you don't think of in that way, but it's like way more of an issue for the dog. So maybe it's porcupine or
cactus
or,
the worst part on porcupines is you get one of two things typically happens, or my experience with porcupines is you either get a dog He has an interaction with a porcupine and he goes, hey, that's a bad idea. We're not going to do that in Northern. And then you have the dog who they have an interaction with a porcupine and they're like, oh, I'm getting revenge. And, you know, that's the worst. I've got a pointer right now. She's 9 and, she's not actively hunting them, but she can't seem to make that connection of this hurts. There's going to be a price to pay if you interact with this animal. I had a Brittany that I stopped taking up to Montana because she was hunting them. I mean, she was actively.
No way.
Yeah. And I know some of the German dogs have a tendency to go that route, you know. Yeah. There's something about porcupines. They smell good to an upland. You know, they smell good. I had a pointer who was my favorite with dealing with them. He'd go on point, and he'd look perfect. I mean, it would look like you were walking into it. And the closer you got to him, you'd get within, say, maybe 10 yards of him. So you're ready. You know, you're starting to, birds are coming. And he'd turn his head and smile at you. And it was like porcupine. You can't tell, you know. Now, bad about grabbing him, but boy, he looked good on porcupine.
Yeah.
You know, and the ones that do that, that's not that big of a deal, you know.
Right. That's better than the alternative.
I had a buddy of mine had a dog that liked to retrieve them.
Yeah, that's tough. You walk out.
Skunks are not as bad. I would rather have a skunk encounter. You know, I'd rather have a skunk encounter than porcupines, but
I thought I had a skunk encounter yesterday. I got 2 English setters and I've been very lucky. No porcupine encounters. Rose, my younger one, she sniffed a couple out when she was young and I had a real close encounter with like a baby porcupine that I thought, okay, this is it. This is my turn. But I was able to get them separated. But yesterday we were out hiking in the woods and I just walked into a wall of skunk and I was like, oh no, like which one am I? And they're zipping by me and I'm like, did you get hit? And I couldn't tell. And we got back to the truck and my truck didn't smell. So I was like, okay, that must've been a close call. But yeah, that's not a good one. Time my older setter Hartley did get blasted by a skunk. That was the only thing. I had to deal with it and that was not fun, but as you said.
Yeah, that's an easier fix. And minor porcupine things are not that bad. You know, you can pop, you know, you get 10 or 12, you know, it's the dog that has them, you know,
and inside then you have
to make a decision at some point, do we go to the vet or not?
So, right.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough.
Yeah. Well, let's steer towards puppies. That was one of the inspirations for me wanting to get in touch with you. So you have a 9-year-old pointer. What's your dog string? Do you have a pup coming this summer? Or where are you at with that?
I'm in a weird spot right now. I have five dogs on my string, which is the lowest number that I've had in a long time. And, 3 of them are 12 and 2 of them are 9. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a very veteran crew. I had a really nice young dog that I was working and he, I got him where I wanted him and everything was going really great. And I had a buddy of mine that was in need of a dog. And so he's with that buddy of mine right now. So I don't know yet what I'm planning on doing. I'm trying to get my numbers down a little bit. I reached a point where I was running about 12 dogs a year and that was too many. I had dogs. I would be out rolling and I would have dogs and I'd look up and I'd have a dog that hadn't been on the ground in like 3 days. Yeah, it's one of those things where that didn't work for me. So I'm trying to figure out where that number lies, you know, right now for me. So we'll see.
You just told me you're basically an empty nester now. You should be growing your string.
Well, I'm not quite at that point yet, but I'm getting close. So we'll see. I haven't quite, like I said, my 2 9-year-olds are in pretty good shape. Actually, my 12-year-olds are in really good shape. They all hunted last year. 2 of them especially are in really good shape. I lost a couple of dogs last summer that I wasn't expecting to lose. I guess he was 9 at the time, and I lost a dog to cancer that I wasn't expecting to. So a little bit of it was kind of sudden. So we'll see. I'm fortunate. I've got a bunch of guys that I hunt with, so there's not a shortage of dogs.
Right. Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah. Do you have all pointers now?
I've got one setter and everybody else's pointers. I am an English pointer guy. I've had German short hairs. I'm a fan of short hairs. But when it comes down to it, English pointers are my dogs. My wife loves setters, and I don't know what I will. My current setter, Cowboy, is he's a bit of a mess. I don't know if he's ruined it. He's not. Yes, he has. He gives me trouble. So I don't know. There's something about setters that appeals to me. So I don't know yet. That is one of my things. I am trying to decide what the next route is. I really like English pointers. I knew
that about you, but yeah, you're preaching to the choir on setters, because yeah. I stumbled into them, as I like to say, and I just they suit me, and
yes,
and they do what I need them to do. So
yeah, my dad was big into setters. My uncle was big into setters. I struggle with the hair. You know, yeah. The hair is a challenge for me,
especially just being where you are.
I
could see the obvious advantage. Like, they're similar in many ways. Like, I could, if I was a southern quail yeah. hunter, I could easily see myself being more of a pointer guy.
They tend to handle the heat better. That's, you know, but so it's just one of those things. You kind of have to me, when you're picking a puppy, you really need to think about where you hunt and how you hunt and what fits you best. And, you know, for what the majority of what I do. And then you also need to think about, you know, what do you love? And it's, you know, I mean, that to me is a big deal. You've got to be careful about it, where you can love a breed and it not be the right choice for the majority of what you do. You know, and, you know, one of the downsides of pointers is that they don't handle cold, you know, in the way that, you know,
the Drahthar or something.
Yeah,
might.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, but I don't handle cold that well either. So it works for me just fine.
Yeah. Yep.
But that is one of those things where you kind of got to think about it and go, okay, well, what am I doing the majority of the time? You know, I've had situations where I had dogs get cold and wet, and pointers where I had to, you know, where, you know, I spend the majority of my time thinking about dogs getting hot and it being dangerous from, you know, from a heat stroke standpoint. But I've had dogs that also, from a cold standpoint, you know, they, you know, you get an English pointer wet and it's cold, and you got to be real careful. You could have a problem. So, you know, so a lot of it just depends on, you know, to me, you need to match the breed to how you spend the majority of your time. I think that's a very important thing that a lot of folks, they get fascinated with a breed and they love the way they look and they love the way they act, but then they put them into situations that, you know, that they're just not designed for. And so you just have to kind of keep that in mind and think about what the majority of what you do.
Yeah. There's a lot of dogs out there, a lot of different variations. They can do a lot of different things, you know, even within a given breed. But I guess I think about, like, you know, think about where you primarily hunt, yeah. and kind of start your search for a breeder geographically. Like,
very
would
much.
You agree with that?
Yeah.
And then kind of look
like
for a breeder that,
you know, the majority of my time is Texas. And Texas, Texas is typically rough country, but it's different. You know, I grew up hunting in cutovers in Mississippi. And so, you know, I've always hunted what I consider to be pretty brutal. Everything will stick you. So it's just tough country. So I want dogs that are coming out of dogs that's where they're, you know, primarily hunted. And so I tend to buy, you know, dogs. When I'm looking at pointers, I'm typically going to be buying pointers that are either coming out of Texas, Oklahoma, Arizona, New Mexico, that's kind of the area that I'm looking at. Or I'm also looking for dogs. Like, I'll buy there's a breeder in Tennessee I like to get dogs from, but he hunts in Texas. And so, you know, so that's the thing that I'm looking for. You know, I'm looking for guys that's where they're hunting. You know, I don't, like, to me, the Dakotas and Montana is easier hunting than Texas is, from the standpoint of, you know, it's just easier country, but I don't hunt up there when it's cold. So,
yep. I could, having not spent a lot of time hunting in the South, other than a brief, trip in Louisiana that we were chasing woodcock. That was a little bit, but yeah, the early season prairie stuff up here that I go and do, that's, I wouldn't, 'cause I mean, tough in certain ways, right?
Yeah.
But it's not tough country like
you. Well, it's not like, you know, everything in Texas will stick you. So, you know, you're pulling porcupine quills out of, you know, I mean, you're pulling, you know, cactus spines out of dogs, you know. But it tends to be, you know, to me, that part of the prairie is a lot easier to hunt in than, you know, and there's some rough country up there. It's not that it's completely easy, but. You know, we've hunted stuff in Texas where, you know, we're chasing blue quail and dogs are running through, you know, and they're just, you know, they're just dodging cactus left and right, you know.
Well, okay. So do you, circling back to pop, the listeners will know this, but it is May 22nd today. We're chatting May 30th. I'm bringing home a new pup, and you know, you've had many dogs over the course of your life. This will be my third dog, and I've a lot of my sort of story and journey with my two dogs has been documented this year on the show, but I'm getting very excited to start a new pup for the third time. And that will be my main sort of project this summer, if you will. And I'm very excited about that. I've learned a lot with dog number one, dog number two, and I'm excited to do it again. Do you still get pretty excited about starting a new pup?
I don't know how you can't, you know? yeah. I mean, to me, The puppy stages to me are the most fun.
Yeah.
And so
not everybody says that, you know.
It depends on what you're trying to do. But to me, developing a puppy, that's my favorite part of, you know, of the
that's cool
game. I mean, it gets you know, it's fun to turn out, you know, older dogs that know what they're doing and you don't have to think about it and they enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, but taking a 6-month old dog and getting them out and getting them into wild birds and, you know, and then being ready and watching them develop and doing those pieces that give them that opportunity. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. I have very fond memories from the first couple of seasons with both of my previous dogs. So I have no doubt I will be just giddy to hit the woods this fall if all goes according to plan. But before that, I've got some work to do. And
oh yeah,
again, it's the basics, the foundation stuff. I mean, it's gonna be really good timing for me getting this pup right at the end of May, and we've got the summer season to kind of get acclimated and do all that stuff. But what do you like to do right away? You know, you got an eight week old puppy. What are some of those things you like to focus on?
There's a couple of things to me that you got to do in that early stage. I think the first thing that you've got to do is you've got to make sure you have some self-control. People get excited about puppies, and they should, but you know, an 8-week old puppy doesn't have the kind of attention span that an older dog's going to have. Yep. And so you've got to break it up throughout the day. And you know, it's 5-minute sessions, 10-minute sessions tops. You know, you don't want to wear them out doing anything. You know, you want to have a, we spend a little time on this, we're done. We come back an hour later, we spend a little time on this, we're done. And you know, if you can do that, if you're fortunate enough to have a situation where you can work throughout the day, you know, you're much better off to have, you know, 5 to 10, you know, 5-minute sessions than an hour of working that dog. And that's tricky, folks. You know, a lot of it depends on what you do for a living and, you know, how you have your time. And so, you know, you've got to restrict that, and be careful about it. Cause what you don't want to do is burn a dog out. You know, you don't want, especially a younger dog. Now, you know, as they age, you can start to increase that. But I like to always leave them wanting more, you know, and I don't want them tired, and I don't want them, you know, going, oh Lord, here he comes again. You know,
I definitely don't want that.
I want it to be short, and we do, you know, a couple of things and we're done. You know, they got to sleep a lot. They get tired quickly. You've got to keep in mind too, this is a new experience for this puppy. You know, they have spent, you know, you pick up an 8-week old dog and, you know, his entire life has been in this litter, and he's had mom for a big chunk of the time. And, you know, he's been weaned off mom, but he still had his, you know, his litter mates. And now you pull him out and he's by himself. And even he's by himself, but he's also being introduced to new dogs, you know? So it's a, you know, you got to be careful how you handle that part of it. So, you know, structuring it so that it works out where, you know, you're able to spend a lot of time with that dog in short sessions throughout the day, you know, that's a big part of it. Then you've got to deal with, it's going to be an inside dog, outside dog. What's your setup?
Yeah, they'll be in. So my setup is actually changed. They're inside dogs. I would describe them that, but I've got a, where I'm talking to you from, this is a spare garage, which is now my office / the bird dog palace, basically. And so they're primarily out here, but I'm glad you asked that, because my first two dogs, when we brought them home, they were inside the house primarily. And so like we're, you know, crate training in the house with us. Now, at some point when my younger dog was, I don't know, one or two, I built the office. This was during COVID. And now they live out here and they're back and forth. They come into the house a couple times a day, but I've been kind of trying to think through, like, that first night, am I going to put the puppy out here with the older dogs, or am I going to have the puppy sleep in its crate in our bedroom to get acquainted with us? I don't know. I haven't decided that yet.
If it was me, I would say do it in the house and crate train him in the house and treat him like he's going to be an inside, you know, dog. Yeah. House, primarily because that's going to give you the opportunity to do that. I'll give you an example. I've got a dog, one of my 12-year-olds. You know, like I said, I've had over the years, you know, I probably had the most bird dogs I've had at one time was probably about 15. And, you know, you can't keep 15 dogs in a house.
Yeah,
you
know, right.
We've got a kennel and I had a dog, he's 12, and I was taking him to the vet. He was having some cancer issues and we were getting some skin cancer taken off, and I just threw him in the front seat of my Jeep and we take off and he kind of loses it just a little bit. And I'm like, what is the deal? It dawns on me, this dog's never been inside, you know, a vehicle like that, you know, because he's always been in a dog truck.
Yeah.
And, price of diesel, my dog truck is currently parked. And so, you know, dog, I just throw him in the Jeep, but he's never ridden in the front seat of a car. So, you know, it's one of those things where I would much rather take that dog and expose him to those things. Even if he's not going to ever do that for the rest of his life, I want him to be comfortable with that. So that's a great time to do that. Now, there's a line in there on crate training. You know, you don't necessarily, it depends on your ability to withstand, you know, the pressure that puppy's going to create. Because that first night in the crate's not going to be fun for anybody. And you've got to have a lot of self-control, and you also have to have your family on board. And, you know, you've got kids at that age that are not, they're going to think that rescuing that puppy and letting the puppy sleep in the pen.
That's true.
Is perfect. Yep. And you don't want to do that crate training. You know, crate training, you've got to learn, okay, you've got to calm down. This is your spot to be, you know, you've got to be quiet and you've got to sleep and you're going to get out of here, but not when you're making a noise, not when you're making a fuss. So there's a line in there of, okay, you know, like with a puppy that age, I'm going to want to get up about every 2 hours and let him out. And, you know, that depends. Is that going to work with your spouse? Is that going to work with kids? So you kind of have to think those things through. One of the things and you know, you talked about it, this is a great time to buy a puppy for you. You've got the summer, you've got time to get this dog at a certain stage, and then he'll be able to hit the hunting season with you. The timing on buying a pup, you know, unless you have, you know, a very free schedule, that's something you got to keep in mind. And you want that pup to be, you know, to come in at a time where it's good for you to do these things, you know, because crate training is a, you know, what, 6-8 weeks, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not gonna have to get up in the middle of the night with that dog forever, but you're gonna have to do it, you know, for a period of time here if you want to be successful. So timing it is, I think, very important. A lot of folks, the worst thing that you can do is buy a puppy spur of the moment. You know, that is a, don't do that. You know, that's a terrible thing to do. You know, you got to time it out where you know, you're going to actually have the time to do these things.
You know,
going back to what we were originally talking about, I would prefer to raise that dog in the house because I want to expose him to those things that are in the house. I don't want him, you know, isolated or sheltered, and I even want to be careful about those other dogs, depending on their personality, but you know, it really doesn't matter. You can have a great older dog who is not going to get along with your puppies. You know, because puppies are going to want to do things, and you know, you just got to control that animal.
I'm going into that with an open mind for sure.
So if it's me, I'm going to raise that puppy in the house until we're fully cray trained, and then go from there.
Yeah, I was kind of leaning that way for what you talked about on the exposure side of things. Like, I want that that pup to learn to be, both my other dogs are good citizens in the house because they started there. So I don't want to lose that. I don't want the pup to come into the house and think it's like a playground or something. So I'll probably do that.
And, you know, it's more of a situation of exposing them to the things that they're going to experience the rest of their life,
yeah.
You know? And, yeah. And that's where it's rare for a dog to be comfortable with things that are unfamiliar.
And slow, yeah.
You know, so that those first, you know, couple of weeks really are important as far as exposure, so that they're comfortable with things. You know, I want a dog yeah. that's as bulletproof as possible as far as its surroundings. And, you know, raising them in a kennel, that's a tricky thing to do. It's yeah. hard to do. And you end up with dogs. I've had some, you know, the majority of my dogs would have been fine house dogs, even though they didn't, that was not their life. I've had a few that, you know, it would not have worked out. You know, they were kennel dogs. Now they were raised in the kennel, so it's hard to say if that's true or not, but
right.
You know, but you have that sometimes. So I want that dog exposed to as much as possible so that they're just comfortable with everything. And you know, that leads into so many other things. You know, sound is such a big thing with bird dogs. To me, kind of the next step, you know, is that sound exposure. There's a, you'll see it on Facebook a lot. I find it incredibly funny, but people will talk about, you know, using pots and pans, for mm-hmm. being a dog. And, you'll get a lot of pushback, people going, you can't do that. And I'm like, well, yeah, actually you can, but I'm not trying to use pots and pans to condition a dog for gunfire. I'm trying to use pots and pans to condition a dog for noise.
Yeah,
you know, because I want a dog that's comfortable with unexpected noises. And so a great way to do that, you know, we used to raise puppies when my father would raise litters. We'd raise them in the laundry room, you know, because there's always something going on there. There's doors been yeah. opened and slammed. And, you know, we always have music on, you know, and these are things that you can do, like with a crate training standpoint. You know, I always have something going on because I want that dog to be comfortable with unexpected noises. Which is not yeah. gunfire conditioning, but it's a precursor to gunfire conditioning.
Yeah.
You know? Yep. So I raise them in the house because I want them used to that. There's always chaos, especially, you know, the age that your kids are. There should be.
I was just gonna say,
kids are great for yeah. raising dogs. They're so. Yep.
There's great gonna for be it. Some unexpected Very stimulus much. And yes. extreme reactions. Yep. Yeah, that'll help.
Yep. The other thing too that's great for that is that you want a dog that's comfortable around kids. Yeah. Even if yep. you're, you know, like I said, you know, I'll eventually have grandchildren that I need my dogs comfortable around. And so that type of exposure, if they don't get that dogs, some dogs have a hard time with kids because they don't recognize them as humans. They think more of them as dogs and they struggle yep. with that because they're, you know, they're also unpredictable and they're right at the eye line and, you know, there's a lot of things yep. there. So
yeah,
I don't see a downside to raising them in the house, especially if you go about it correctly.
Right.
And yep. in your, you know, getting your family on board, that's a big deal. Yeah. That's
yeah.
huge.
Yeah. And I'm in a good place for that. Everybody's excited for that. So, that'll be good, but you're hitting on something that is really it's kind of at the forefront of my mind, which is just that over the course of a dog's life, all of this, you know, 10 years, 10, 12, 15 years is a long time. And you will find that, like, I've realized this over time, that you never know, like, what situation you're going to be at, somebody's house and a new yard. And the more you have your dog being used to going into uncomfortable or unusual situations, not normal situations, and just being a good citizen is really, really, you appreciate that in a dog over time.
And it's hard to take a dog that hasn't been exposed to those things as an older dog and get them comfortable with it. It is difficult to do. And so, you don't want that. You don't want a dog that's unpredictable and that is stressed out. And so, you know, now the word that we may have left out is gradual. You know, it's not one of those things where you know, my favorite thing is the people that take a dog out and go, hey, we're going to fire off this 12 gauge, you know, 5-shot semi-automatic. And we're going to find out if this dog's gunshot, you know, well, he is now. So it's one of those things of gradual exposure, you know, to everything. And you have to watch that dog and you have to see what that dog's comfortable with and what they're not, and just gradually introduce, you know, everything. Crate training is something that we don't see this much in the hunting dog side of the world. We see it a lot in the pet side, where people are
afraid to put their dog in a crate.
No, I don't even know if afraid's the right word for it. They think it's wrong.
That, yeah,
you'll run into that where they think that it's some sort of punishment. And, you know, even if you're not going to crate that dog, which personally I think is a horrible idea, but you need to have a dog that's comfortable with it. And I'll give you a primary example. I was out of town this week and I have a dog, this older dog of mine, he's 12 and he's got some skin cancer issues and had to have surgery. And, you know, I was going to be out of town and it's going to be, you know, he needed direct, you know, it was one of those things where I timed it out where I was like, look, go ahead and do the surgery. I dropped him off the day that I left town. This way he'll be at the vet. You know, I'll be gone for 5 or 6 days. We'll get past most of that. But he had to be in a crate the entire time. But, you know, he's used to that. It's not a big deal to him. But to make matters worse, he got an infection during the, you know, after the surgery. They ended up having to do a second surgery on him. And so, you know, so he's going to spend, you know, easily, you know, 12, you know, 15 days, you know, in a crate. Well, he's used to that. It's not a big deal to him. And so he's fine with it. But you take a dog that's never been crate trained, and then you have to put him in that situation for whatever reason. You know, you end up with a dog that is very stressed out, very uncomfortable. He's fighting the whole thing where, you know, this dog of mine, you know, it's just, you know, you look,
no big
times
deal.
He's fine. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
He knows how to deal with that. So, yeah, but those things, you start with a puppy. That's how you do it.
I do. You obviously it's, you know, slow and steady, gradual. That is the one thing I recall specifically my first dog. Like I was so green. I was so worried that I was going to miss like some magical window to like accomplish something that I put more pressure on myself. And thankfully, like I didn't put a ton of pressure on the dog, or like I didn't make mistakes in that like I would like, oh, I really regret that. But I learned that, you know, you have time, you know, you can be patient, you're better off doing things gradual in that way. Don't put so much pressure on yourself that, oh, I've got to have, you know, bird intro completed at this specific time. You know, let the dog kind of tell you the timeline, but just do little things every day and you'll figure it out. You find that sweet spot.
I think that people do get wrapped up in bird and gun intro. To me, they're huge deals, but there's a lot of stuff that you need to do prior to that so that goes well. And that's where I think some people get, they kind of miss the boat on that. But I want that dog, you know, we're trying to teach certain things, you know, in that stage. Table work is probably the next thing that I like to add in when we have part of the conversation. All right. Do you do table work? Do you have a table? What's your,
I really don't. And I was just going to ask you if you are a big like place trainer. I think with the one thing that I wanted to improve or correct with my second dog was I wanted her to be calm. Like I wanted to be a calming presence around her. Cause I was so excited with my first dog. I feel like I kind of put some of that into him. And so I wanted Rose to be calm. So I know I put her up on a table. I don't really have a setup here that like, this is my training table, but I'm definitely thinking about that because I want my hands on the dog and all that
stuff.
There's
a lot of different things that you can do it. And to me, table work and patience kind of go hand in hand. So for me, table work, I want a table that is comfortable for me to stand, you know, comfortably stand and the dog be where, you know, where I could put my hands on them, at, you know, sort of waist height. A little bit of it depends, you know, you'll know it when you see it sort of thing. But I want to be able to comfortably stand there and put my hands on the dog. So many pieces of training come into this. I want that dog where it's off the ground, which first off puts the dog in a little bit of a uncomfortable is not the right word, but it's not what they're necessarily used to. It also gives me the advantage because I'm comfortable and I'm able to do these things. And I want to teach that dog to stand still while I have my hands on him. And that comes into just an enormous amount of things. While we're doing that, we're going to take our hands and we're going to put our hands everywhere on that dog. I need a dog that's comfortable with me touching feet, toenails, mouth, eyes, tail, you know, everywhere. Because I want that dog, first off, I want that dog comfortable with that, but there's going to be times where I'm going to have to do things. You know, we started talking about porcupines. You know, it's going to be a fight no matter what. A dog that's not comfortable with you putting your hands on them, it's a problem. You know, you've got to boot dogs in a lot of the places that we are. And people will talk about, is it hard to put boots on? It's like, no. And they're like, well, I have struggled putting boots on my dog. And I'm like, well, will he stand still? No. Okay. Well, that's why you're struggling with it. But that starts with the puppy, you know, and the puppy's not going to be comfortable with that. They're going to wiggle and they're going to try and move around. And if you allow them to break free, you know, at that stage, they're going to figure out all I got to do is put up a little fight. And this guy give up. He gives up quick. So we got, you know, there's always training going on. You know, every time you touch the dog, either you're training them or they're training you. And so there's always that point in there where you've got to do that. But, you know, you have a dog that's uncomfortable getting their toenails cut. Well, that's because no one's ever touched their feet. You've got a dog that you can't take something out of their mouth, you know, but they're not used to you having your hands on them. Ears, huge deal. So we do that at a table because at the end of a hunt, you know, I want that dog to jump up on a tailgate or, you know, I've got a stand where they jump up on, and I'm going to just run through everything real quick just to make sure, you know, because I've had dogs get cut up in the field and not realize it because of the angle that it was at, until we get back to the truck. And so, you know, you want to be able to check them fully. Well, you can't do that if they won't stand still. And so the table, you know, leads to that. Now, there's a lot of other things that you could do with that table training. You know, it can be a precursor to teaching whoa. It can be a precursor to teaching steady to winged shot. You know, it, part of a trained retrieve, you know, deals with a table. So there's a lot of different, you know, pieces that come into that. You mentioned place training. Place training to me is a little bit, it's not something that I grew up with, but it's an important part of what we do today. Not exactly the same thing as table work, but it ties into it. To me, place training is more crate training, or at least part of it, you know, and it's the dog go to a specific spot and stay there. It has some differences to it, but to me, it's not the same thing as table work. But same thing there, it's teaching this dog, okay, you know, you have to be in this spot and you have to have some self-control and you can't do something just because you want to do it. You've got to stay in this spot. You know, place training for me is 4 feet on, you know, this spot. You stay here until I tell you, you know, otherwise. So they all kind of tie in together. One of the things we were talking about on patience training, not as important for a bird dog as it is for waterfowl. Dog, but it still has its place. And so, you know, we'll go to a spot and we'll sit and we'll start off with, you know, depending on the dog and the age of the dog, you know, we'll sit there for just a minute and then we'll get up and we'll go. And then next time we'll come back and we'll do it for 2 minutes and then we'll do it for five and then 10 and then 30. And, you know, you teach that dog that, hey, we're going to take a break and we're sitting here and we're just going to be, you know, we're not doing anything.
It's okay to just be here.
It's okay to be. And it's not even it's okay to be. It's expected to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can do that. You know, there's a lot of different pieces to that, but it's a gradual build over time. Same thing with the table. I want that dog to be comfortable sitting on that table and standing there for 30 minutes with me with my hands on. And you don't do that on day one. You know, that is not a day one thing. You know, it might just be all right, we're going to get you up here and we're going to get you. And as soon as you relax, I'm going to let you get. You know, and so they pick up very quickly that once the hands are on, I got to just relax. And the quicker I relax, the faster we're going to get through whatever it is that we're doing.
Yeah. And that's kind of the maybe the nuanced thing that if you are getting your first bird dog this summer, maybe you not know that, but you're trying to get that response from the puppy. So, and you have to pay attention to the timing of everything. So when the puppy is calm, that's when puppy gets to move, that sort of thing. And you pick up on that, but it's not the obvious stuff as a first time bird dog owner.
You know, they both, and you might recognize this from a shooting standpoint. It took me a long time to come to terms with both of these things, but for some reason, and I'll be specific and say American men, are under the impression that they know how to train dogs instinctively and that they know how to shoot.
Yep.
And so from a bird hunting standpoint, both of those things seem to be something that folks don't, you know, they are always hesitant to want to learn.
Yeah.
I just find it humorous, you know.
I think there's like a weird thing where it's like you have to kind of think contrarian, but it's just like it's sometimes it's like the opposite of what you're thinking needs to happen for you to move forward and make progress.
Yeah. And it is a constant learning, you know. I don't know what the number is for me. I'm not a pro trainer. But I expect I'm in the 60, 75 dogs, somewhere in that neighborhood. And every one of them's different, and every one of them's a learning experience. You know, you something new comes up every time. I get the opportunity to see other disciplines, you know, where I don't just deal with bird dogs. And so I get the opportunity to pick up on a lot of things that other disciplines do that has never been done, you know, in the bird dog world. And that's always neat.
I did ask about place training, because that's like, I'm envious of like the guy that can go bring his dog into a hunting camp mm-hmm. and say, lie down right there. And the dog just stays there. I look at that. I'm like, wow, I've not really tried sure. to do that with my previous two dogs, but it's one of my aspirations for the new pup.
Well, and that's once again, that's a teachable thing. Now you'll have you'll have dogs that like we have German Shepherds, and my Shepherds have a tendency to be that way. You know, where they want to be close to me, and they want to be, you know, they want to be in the room and relaxed. And so they do a lot of that, and they're used to that. But, you know, bird dogs, that's not their go-to. And so you kind of have to teach them to have that off switch. Some dogs are better at it than others, and you have to recognize that. But all of that is trained. You know, that is all trained.
How about stakeouts, chains, that kind of thing that I was telling you I've got to get? I have two of my stakeout posts that I bought from Gun Dog Supply way back when, and I got to add a third one.
Okay, so I would tell you that you may want to rethink. Are you doing like the individual stakes that?
Well, I have the individuals, but with three dogs, I can potentially have a whole string now, right?
So there's some advantages there, and we grew up with that. At the time, we called them chain gangs. They were primarily made out of chain. Nowadays, we do cable gangs. So it's a little easier. It depends on what your setup is as to which one I recommend. But basically, you know, it's with three dogs, it's going to be two stakes in the ground and then a cable that goes from stake to stake. And then you'll have drops off of those. So you'll have three drops off of those. And so it gives you the advantage of being able to put, you know, two stakes in the ground instead of three. But the biggest advantage of it is that it teaches a dog to give to pressure at the neck. Because if one dog moves, the other dogs feel it. And so they learn to give to that pressure. And so it's a precursor for check cord work. And so that dog learns to, you know, they learn to give to it. And then they also do a little bit of training for you, because that young dog figures out pretty fast that the other dogs are going to make him stand still. And so, you know, so they learn pretty much to just relax. And so it's a really excellent training thing. The other advantage of it is that, you know, you can set one up permanently if you want to, where you do the majority of your training, and other dogs can watch. And that does a lot of things. It can build desire, but it can also, you know, it can teach patience, but it also gives them exposure to things. They get to see birds fly and they don't get to chase. And, you know, so there's a lot of things there. So I would probably at this point look at, you know, what's have and probably go to, you know, to a stakeout, to go from.
I didn't even think about that with two stakes already. If I were to get a cable gang, then in I won't have three dogs forever. Like two is kind of the sweet spot for where my family is and stuff, but then I'd have those two. But yeah, I think you're right. I think you just talked me into a cable gang.
Yeah.
What other must have gear thing? You know, I've got crates, you know, I have a lot of it. I've accumulated a lot of the stuff. I've got collars and stuff. I do want to ask you about, Garmin GPS collars before we wrap up here, but any other like must-have things for new puppy owners?
First two things that I want with a puppy. I want a collar for that dog. Even straight out, you know, when I go to pick up a puppy, I've got a collar with me. I want my name and phone number on that dog immediately. But the other thing that I want is I want a D-ring on that collar and I want a drag line. And so I like having 6 foot, extremely light, you know, something with a snap on it. And when I say a drag line, it means that it doesn't have a loop. It doesn't have a knot in the end. It's just a, you know, it's a light piece of rope and I have something super light for a puppy. And that's strictly so that I can get my hands on that dog all the time. I don't want to have to run them down. I don't want them to have the opportunity really to get away from me. I want to give them some freedom. I want to let them be able to move around, but I also want to be able to get my hands on them. And by having a drag line, I don't have to get my hands on them. I just have to get my hands on that rope. Now I've got the ability to teach them to go with me. You know, it's a precursor to teaching a heel. It's a precursor to get a dog that'll walk comfortably on a, you know, on a loose leash. And it's a precursor to check cord work. And it allows me to take that dog out in the field and change directions and get him to move with me and get him to start keying off of my movements. And so to me, you know, that's the thing. I sell gear for a living, so I don't mind that people get excited about puppies and want to buy gear. But you don't need a crazy amount of stuff to start off with. You know, you need, like I said, a collar and a leash. And you're going to need, you know, in the first 6 months, probably three collars in the grand scheme of things. So I usually keep, you know, if I'm rolling through puppies, I've usually got a puppy collar. You know, you want to check that ID plate, make sure that it's still correct. You know, if you've changed something, cell phones have kind of fixed some of that nowadays. You know, some of my ID plate stuff comes back from the day when we moved and had to change phone numbers. Nowadays, you know, I've you know, your phone number's your, but you want to make sure, you know, that you've got a name and a phone number on there. And then drag lines are a big deal. You know, stuff to retrieve and stuff to chew. Those are two separate things. We don't retrieve things that we chew. We don't chew things that we retrieve. Those are important. Both things are important, but we want to keep in mind that if it's a chew toy, we don't throw it for them. And so, you know, that's about it. You know, good feed bowls, good water bowls. You know, beyond that, having a crate. One of the things on crates that's tricky, I like to have a small crate for puppies. This is a thing that can get expensive for folks, you know, because it's going to be a crate that you're not going to need that often. Having too big of a crate is a problem, you know, because they figure out if you're not diligent on your housebreaking, you know, they figure out pretty quick, well, this crate's big enough. I'm comfortable. I can, you know, I can relieve myself over on this side and sleep on this. You don't want that. So, but as far as that goes, you know, that's the main stuff that you need. Yeah.
What is there a good like puppy chew toy that you like or have, or,
you know, that sort of varies with folks. I try to find stuff that the dogs like. I like the more natural stuff. I prefer like antler chews. I'll do, like knuckle bones, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm not a fan of raw hides. I'm not a giant fan of the plastic stuff that you chew on. It's popular, but I don't feel for it. I'd rather be natural. Like I said, antlers for me are probably the best thing. You know, and whether that's a, you know, you find an antler or you buy an antler.
Yep. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I'm pretty well set up for, I've got some, you know, some of the old wire crates and stuff that will start in the smaller stuff, and got little areas. I have a fenced in backyard here, which I do know I got to get to work here. It's got some areas where my dogs, when we put the fence in, my dogs were old enough that they didn't test the boundaries, but there's some not puppy safe openings in the fence.
You know, so. And people tend to think you're going to have some puppies that are homebodies and they're not going to go anywhere, but they know the difference between, you know, running out when we're hunting and not. And then you have some dogs that they're going to check every spot every day. You know, I was talking about that setter that I have. He's that way. Still to this day, he's 9 years old. I guarantee you, I turn him out, he's going to check every opportunity to see if he can go. It's easier to get, you know. But it's not necessary that I go with it. So, so every dog's a little different that way.
That's funny. That's funny. Well, I've got to, the thing I'm stuck on is I got to come up with a name for this pup, Steve.
That's,
do you have a system for that?
I keep a list. So I have a list in my phone of names that I've used and names that I like. And so if I run across and you say a cool dog name, I'm like, oh yeah. And I'll put that on the list. I have more dog names than I'll ever have dogs, I expect, but it is one of those things. I like short names that are easy to call. I don't like, as a general rule, I don't like, two syllable. I prefer one. I've mentioned Cowboy and Freddy, and both of them are two syllable, but it's not a hard and fast rule. You need something that you can call in the field that's easy, that carries. But it's just one of those things. And sometimes you need to meet the dog. I've had two or three dogs, I would say, over my career that I named before I got and changed because it just didn't fit. And so you have an enormous amount of time for that. It's not a requirement that it come up. We have changed dogs' names before. That is I don't do it anymore, but from time to time we have bought dogs that were older dogs, and you can change a dog's name, over time. It helps if they're similar, but that can be done. So find something you like. You have kids old enough now that they should be involved with that.
They're going to have an input. Yes. Yep. But yeah. There's some candidates being floated around.
Well, sure. You need veto power. Keep that in mind that you have.
Yes. Yeah. I've got to make
take input,
that.
But we have full veto power.
There have been some like 3 and 4 syllable names suggested that a veto.
Yeah.
Got to be able to shorten it up.
And keep in mind, it's okay to have a call name and a long drawn out, what you call them sort of thing. So both of those are fine.
It's possible that this name might not get determined until pup comes home. My first two, like my first dog, I had the name picked out probably like a year in advance.
Right.
Then my second dog, I didn't struggle too hard. Her name's Rose. One syllable, nice and short. I love that. It fits her perfectly. But this other one, I thought about it a little bit and just not that one candidate did not jump out at me. And it just kind of like, I've got like writer's block or something. It's just like a blank screen right now.
Yeah,
so
it will, like a lot of other things, it'll come to you.
I'm not stressing about it.
Yeah, there's no need to.
Plenty of time.
Awesome. Well, I did ask, I mentioned the Garmin. One thing I'm curious about, because I think you've had hands-on with the new beeper that they came out with. Just kind of curious what your thoughts, what you've seen from that, and then anything new in the Garmin space.
So I was shocked that they came out with a beeper, to be totally honest with you. We have been asking for a beeper almost since day one.
Yep.
Of
I would be shocked if you and I didn't talk about that when you were on the show back in 2018.
Yeah. And
I'm sure we did.
So I saw that beeper first. So I probably saw you at Pheasant Fest. It's Pheasant Fest in Kansas. So we had a Garmin meeting shortly after that. And that's the first time that I was even mentioned, that the beeper was mentioned to me. And I actually got to see it on that trip. I had said a week before, I did a Facebook post just saying, hey, we're meeting with Garmin. Does anybody have anything that they want to talk about? And in that post, I said, don't ask me about a beeper. It's never. So that's
right now. Yeah.
It's a really well done setup as far as in the system. We had a beeper option in the regular e-collar part, when Garmin took over the 550, they had a beeper, and that beeper would work with those collars. And to me, it made a lot of sense not to really think about a beeper, because GPS takes over a lot of that stuff. The problem that you run into is that most of the guys that really wanted a beeper were the grouse guys. And unless you've hunted that kind of stuff, you don't have an appreciation for how difficult it is to hunt in some of that cover, and how thick it is, and how close a dog can be to you and you not know what's going on. And the other downside of GPS is that it's not great inside of, you know, 20 feet.
When you get real close.
Yeah, you get close to it and it no longer, you know, and that there's a reason for that. That's a, you know, a civilian GPS is designed. It's not that accurate when you're super close to it. That's intentional. And so, you know, so it is one of those things that they kind of missed out on that mark. So we've come back around to it. So the TT25, you can either buy it in a beeper setup or you can add a beeper to it. So if you already have a TT25, you can just buy the add-on piece. And it works well. It works with both the Alpha 200 and 300 series.
Okay. It also, not the 100?
It does not work with the 100.
Okay.
So the 25s will work with the 100, but you don't have beeper control. I don't know if they're capable of doing that. Still a lot of 100s out on the market. I would love to see that as an option, but right now it is not. So 200, 300, you can do that. Pro 550 Plus also has beeper controls. And so all the stuff that's current, you know, you have the ability to turn the beeper on and off. You can change volume and you can change sounds from the handheld.
Right.
It's got to run.
I like that feature, the volume and the sounds. Yeah.
The volume is a big deal. We haven't had that in most of our setups. And it is you can actually control it from the handheld. So if you need to increase the volume, you can do it from your handheld. It works, you know, it works well. It's not as independent from the GPS as maybe I would like. That's another thing that we're working right now, trying to get changed. And I don't know if this will ever happen. I would love for people to be able to change the timing on the point indicator. You know, if you're familiar with the point indicator on the Garmin units, a dog.
7 seconds.
Well, you know, a dog can be stopped and you might even miss that first one.
Yeah. Right. Because
the GPS is trying to determine, and they don't want it where, you know, it's not as immediate as some people might like. And there's a reason for that. You know, you don't want that beeper going off constantly. You don't want indicator going off constantly. I would prefer if the individual could select that where it was quicker than not. Have not convinced Garmin of that, you know, yet. Maybe we may get that. The beeper, I've got some videos, we have them on YouTube. We have them on Facebook, TikTok. And you can see the timing, you know, where you can see where the beeper kicks in and then the point indicator, you know, shortly kicks in after that. You know, if you're a grouse hunter and you want to be able to, you know, hear where that dog is, or you want to be able to press a button and hear where that dog is, you've got that as an option. So, I'm not going to say it's perfect, but it's close to as far as what we're looking for in a beeper. I always kind of lean toward I would prefer the consumer have more control as far as it being adjustable than not. That there's a fine line in there that we miss sometimes. And then there's that line in there where it can add such a high level of complexity that it's tough on a consumer. So it's always a toss up as far as what we want and what we get. But, you know, if you want a beeper and you want remote control over it, this is a great addition to the, you know, to the line that Garmin.
Yep. I'm a grouse hunter. So I was one of those people that was like, GPS does 99% of what I needed to do, but it's just those certain scenarios. And I always just wanted, I don't need it on all the time. I just want to be able to hit locate when I can't see my dog and I'm in tight, just to figure out where it is. And I always thought, you know, they've got the tone in there. Like if I could just turn that tone up a little bit, like we changed the volume, but they added it. And that's how I would use it. I still run a bell because I want the instant feedback. I want to know if my dog stops and he's 60 yards away. I'm not waiting for the GPS, but I wouldn't hunt without a GPS, but I do appreciate being able to use the bell for instant feedback. And then now this locate feature would be handy at times.
So kind of going back to what we were talking about, I have two situations that go back to the puppy part. I grew up running bells and then moved to beepers at a certain point. When it came up to start testing this product, I didn't have a single dog on my string that knew what a beeper was. And you know, to me, conditioning a dog for a beeper is similar to conditioning one for gunfire. You can't strap that thing on and turn it on and expect the dog to know what's going on, especially if you run like in point mode only. The dog locks up on point and all of a sudden this, you know, sounds like a garbage truck backing up, you know, just comes on and it's loud and he's not expecting it. So you have to condition a dog for a beeper, you know, and I do that around the house. You can also, you know, this one has a volume control, which is great, but you can also,
that's nice.
Yeah. You can do some stuff. You can take a piece of tape and put it over the speaker horn and cover, you know, 75% of it. And it'll muffle that sound a lot. You know, you want to start off and just get them used to going, okay, well, this is a sound that we get used to. And then this is a sound that just appears out of nowhere sometimes. I had a dog that I tried to run a bell on, that same thing there, never seen a bell before. I had a situation where I was like, oh, it'd be kind of cool to do this. And this is a dog that was used to everything. And he was probably 10 at the time. And, you know, he'd been exposed and hunted all across the country and just tough as just one of the best dogs I've ever had. I strapped a bell on him. And he shut down. He had no idea what to do. It completely derailed him. So same thing there. He just never experienced it before. And, you know, so you got to be careful about that kind of stuff and be aware of what your dog has experienced.
Everything needs to be introduced and conditioned typically. I mean, you never know how the dog's going to respond, but I did the same thing. Actually, my younger setter, Rose, she always runs with the same bell. And I maybe told the story once before, but we went out grouse hunting and I don't remember, either a collar was dead or something happened where I was like, okay, I'll just strap this other collar on her with Hartley's bell. Mm-hmm. And she hit the ground ready to take off and hit the cover, which she loves to do. She took two steps and that different sound of the bell, she froze. Yep. And she just stopped. I was like, okay,
how is that?
That's not going to work.
Yeah. You know, learning your dog and knowing that kind of stuff and just always, always working from the perspective of, okay, this is new or this is different. You know, we're going to gradually do this. And those expectations, that's a skill that most of us don't have. And those of us that do know it still have to keep that in mind.
Okay. Last thing on the Garmin collars, because this one comes up a lot. I've got, I have a smaller female. My new setter that I'm getting is a smaller dog. I still run one of the TT15 minis, because I like that, but it'll act up every once in a while. And I know I'm going to have to replace it eventually, but I know the TT25s are, there's only one of them. But there seems to be different, like short, like there's a smaller collar band, or explain that for me.
So if you've had them for a time, everything that we've had prior to the TT25, the flex band is what we're talking about here. The flex band is the piece, the little box that's up on the that's away from the electronics. That's your GPS antenna. And there's a wire that runs from that GPS antenna down to the box, the piece that's underneath the dog's neck. And so that's called a flex band. Prior to the 25 coming out, flex bands were built in and, you know, they were a permanent piece of the unit. The 25, it's a user replaceable piece. And so you can unscrew it and replace it if you need to. They're built incredibly well. We're not seeing broken flex bands. That doesn't happen. Or it's a rarity. I'm not gonna say it can't happen, but it's much rarer in the 25s. But the problem with a flex band is that, especially on a track and train collar, is that you've got to be able to get that collar tight enough that your probes are getting skin contact. Well, what Garmin has as the regular size is going to be a problem for so Cowboy is about 35 pounds.
That's about how big Rose is.
I use 40 pounds is kind of my line. It's not a dead set thing, but if you've got a dog that's under 40 pounds, a regular flex band is probably, you're going to have a hard time getting it tight enough to have good skin contact. But what they've done is they've come out, we call them minis. It's a little different from 15 mini. If you take a 15 mini and you put it next to a 15 regular, you know, the electronics are substantially smaller, the flex is shorter. The 25, the electronics are the same. They're all about the exact same size of what you have in that mini. So a regular 25 is actually smaller than a 15, but the flex band is substantially shorter. And so when we talk about a mini 25, basically we're talking about a shorter flex band. the beauty of that, and all bird dogs, I'm going to recommend to many. And even, you know, you've got some 60 and 65 pound German Shorthairs. You've got some bigger dogs, you know, that are out there, and they can wear a regular. The problem with that is that your puppy can't. And so we see no difference in performance versus a regular flex band versus a mini flex band. And so there's really no upside to a regular. And so I run all minis, and I recommend, you know, if you've got a bird dog, or if you're going to have more than one bird dog, I want a collar that'll fit everybody. I don't want to have to go, well, we'll use this one for that dog and this one for that dog. So I recommend minis for everybody. Personally, I recommend minis across the board. You know, even if I'm running, you know, for guys that are running hounds, I'd rather have a mini than a regular, mainly because it's lower surface area there. Like if you're running hog dogs, or you're running coyote dogs, or you're running, you know, bears or cats, you know, you have opportunities for your collars to get damaged because you have opportunities for your dogs to get damaged. And so I like a mini flex band because it's a shorter, you know, the distance between the electronics and the antenna and the wire are shorter. I just, it's a smaller surface area, but the performance is identical. So to me, there's no advantage to running a regular minis or the 25 minis, or it's perfect collar.
Yeah, that's helpful. I would not have known that. And yeah, that's good information. So I could order that directly, but it sounds like you could also retrofit an existing.
Yeah, if you have a regular, you can buy just the mini flex band, and you can, it's two screws, you can switch it out. But you don't have to do that. You can buy, you could buy just a mini. And like I said, we call it a TT25 mini. Garmin doesn't always refer to them that way, but very early on, people were already comfortable with the concept of that. And so, it throws folks a little bit because they're thinking, hey, the electronics are smaller. They're not. It's the same electronics, but it's a smaller electronic box now. It's very similar in size to what you have in that TT15 mini. But all I run are minis. That's all I recommend for bird dog folks.
Cool. All right, buddy. Well, thank you for the time. I really appreciate you joining us once again on the Bird Shop Podcast, gundogsupply.com for all of our gun dog needs, right? Okay. You guys are, you got a YouTube channel, and you're putting out videos, and you've always been doing that. I remember watching gear videos before I got my first dog 12, 13 years ago. So yeah, keep up the great work.
We'll appreciate it. Thanks a lot. And anytime we can help with anything, let us know.
All right. Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Bird Shop Podcast. That does it. We'll see you on the next episode, everybody. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here with one more thing before you go. I want to thank you for joining us for this episode of the Bird Shop Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to learn more. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I'll send you some of these Bird Shop Podcasts, can coolers, and stickers as a thank you from me. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Bird Shop Podcast.